Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. Today's theme is wonder, and we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona in research, in staff and what staff and faculty are doing to guide the students, and all the things that are happening that enhance Tucson, enhance the community, but also enhance the world. And we've, over the last many shows, we've demonstrated that the impact that the University of Arizona has on so many aspects of our life here in Tucson, but around the world. And one of those interesting things is we have the world-famous Tree Ring Research Lab at the University of Arizona. And with us this morning is Brian Black. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your journey and how you got to the University of Arizona and how you ended up over at the Tree Ring Research Lab.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Pennsylvania and did all my graduate work at Penn State University in forest ecology and the ecology and development of Appalachian forests. And so I specialized in part in tree ring research, especially these long histories of eastern forests. And at the time I was finishing my PhD, I saw an advertisement for a postdoctoral position at the Oregon State University Hatfield Marine Science Center, where they were interested in finding someone to perform growth increment analysis in long-lived fish. And I had no idea that fish lived a long time or that they formed rings just like trees do. And I was intrigued by that and applied and said, well, I have this tree ring background, and as a tree ring scientist, here's how I would analyze these data, the rings and these long-lived fish. And so was selected for the job. That the lab took that chance at the Hatfield, and I took that chance as well to do a complete disciplinary expansion, I would say, bringing tree ring work into the marine sciences, right, and to develop and apply these tree ring techniques for fish. And so was at the Hatfield for a number of years before coming to Arizona, also a stop in Texas.
And the tree ring research lab at the U of A is world renowned. It's located in an interesting place, right?
Yes. It used to be based in the stadium,
right?
So in the west end of the stadium. And in 2013, we were built a whole new building,
right?
A beautiful new facility now that houses our department.
There were two things in the stadium at one point. There was the tree ring lab, and then there was the mirror lab, where they were making giant mirrors for telescopes on the other side. You would never know that they were underneath the stadium there. And now what is tree ring research just in general, as somebody who may not know exactly what that means? Why are tree rings so important, and how do they help us understand the world?
Well, as I think everyone knows, that as trees grow, they form a ring every year. And those rings are time capsules, and their properties tell us about the environment those trees experienced as they grew very far back in time, much prior to instrumental records or written records, so that we can go back thousands of years to learn about environmental variability of the past, not only on Earth, but even of the sun, which is one area we're expanding into at the Tree Ring Lab by analyzing not only the anatomical properties of those rings, but also the chemical and isotopic, like radiocarbon or oxygen-18, that tell us these different aspects of Earth's climate in the past, and even how it's been influenced by cosmic rays, or the detailed anatomical properties of the ring, where we can thin section these tree ring samples and analyze the cellular structure and the subcellular structure to tell us what kind of environmental conditions those trees experienced within a year. So we can even get this very precise subannual resolution, not only for climate, but also natural disasters. I've been working a lot on dating major earthquakes and their frequency and how faults are linked, major volcanic events, where there's an effort now to try to figure out what was the year that Mount Mazama erupted, that formed Crater Lake, which was one of the largest eruptions on the planet in the last 10,000 years, and is a major temporal marker for stratigraphic studies throughout Western North America.
Very similar to a geographic study, where, you know, land lays on top of each other over time. And so when there's a seismic shift and the land raises up, and they can look and see, basically trace the geology back, the history of the Earth back through those different layers. a tree does the same thing. It captures that each year as it grows out, it's capturing the history of what happened during that year for scientists to look at later, right?
That's right. And so we sample those trees and then work that puzzle. We do some pattern matching techniques to assure that every tree ring is assigned the correct exact calendar year in which it formed, so that we can get these very high resolution year by year histories that in some cases can go back 10,000 years or longer,
right?
Year by year by year.
So we don't have any 10,000 year old trees that I know of in the world, but we do have some 2,000 year old trees that you could take a sample from. But so some of these samples are they would be basically rocks at some point, right? They would turn into something at some point. But
yes, tree samples can persist for surprisingly long amounts of time on the forest floor. For example, at the bristlecone pines at high elevation in the Southwest and Northern California and across Nevada, some of those trees can live up to 5,000 years.
Oh, really?
That we know of. And then it's such a harsh environment that when trees die, they're very well preserved. So you can go back and take samples of those dead trees on the forest floor and then continue the chronology continuously back through time over millennia. Or, for example, trees are well preserved in lakes. We sampled trees in a lake with underwater hydraulic chainsaws that had been preserved over 1,100 years whenever an earthquake occurred that thrust up a rupture, a fault that impounded a stream and flooded a lake. And by sampling those trees that had been drowned at the time of that earthquake, we could tell the exact calendar year and even season of when that earthquake occurred because of this preservation of wood.
So there are some trees on the earth that are 5,000 years old then?
Yes, yeah. There are.
Wow. I thought it was about 2,000, but 5,000 is a long time.
That's our oldest.
Yeah. And then obviously if a forest is up in the ice area too, and it got a lot of snow, and they can be preserved for a long time in ice as well, right?
Bogs are probably our best for preservation and underwater.
Right.
As you get really far north and in the icy areas, we don't get trees.
Oh, there are more trees, yeah.
Then we look for other indicators, ice cores and even shells, which I've been getting into, that we get these high latitude, long-lived clams that behave like trees.
We're talking with Brian Black from the Tree Ring Research Lab at the University of Arizona. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about his current research on sea creatures and how they also have the property of ring research that you're working on with trees. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030. We'll be back after the break and talk a little bit about the exciting things going on at the University of Arizona in terms of ring research for both trees and sea creatures. We'll be back just after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the interesting and cool things going on at the University of Arizona. One of those neat things is the Tree Ring Research Lab, and Dr. Brian Black is with the Tree Ring Research Lab Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the current research that you're doing on something really, really interesting, which is the fact that coral and rockfish and other thing would have this similar elements to it, that you can study the lives of sea creatures and come up with a history of them, but also their environment that they're in. It's very unique and interesting work.
Thank you. Yes, and I was amazed to see that so many organisms form rings like trees that have annual growth and can live multiple decades or centuries within the world's oceans and even freshwater environments, and that we could apply the same fundamental tree ring techniques to those organisms to address analogous issues in the oceans as we do on land with trees, and then even link across the two systems, how the oceans and the terrestrial systems interrelate with one another.
And so you're looking at organisms like corals and rockfish, but corals specifically, coral reefs are obviously having their own challenges right now. And that challenge of climate change or bleaching or whatever would be going on in those corals is actually being documented by those corals right now. And so 100 years from now, 300 years from now, someone could look back and say, and 2024, here's what happened in the waters around this coral reef. Hopefully it's still there, and discuss that. So it's kind of like recording what is happening, right?
Yes, that's an excellent point, that these corals and clams and fish are all flight recorders of their environment, so that we can collect an individual that might have lived 100 years ago and see what conditions were like, or if we go 100 years in the future and look at the rings from 2024, it would provide some indication of the environment these organisms are experiencing now.
What kind of things are you finding? Are you, as research coming back, data coming back, that you can say, can you say in this particular area the water is getting warmer, or can you say that that there's different kinds of sea life that has been here and gone away or come back, or what kind of data are you finding?
Yeah, so I specialize especially in higher latitude environments. So we get the tropical corals, and there's a lot of work in that area with a number of very talented coral researchers, some even here at the University of Arizona. And I study clams and fish, especially in the North Pacific, though I've had work throughout the North Atlantic and even off Australia, other places around the world where these techniques can be applied. But in the North Pacific, I started especially with rockfish, which can live 100, 200 years. Mm. It's a variety of fish that live all along the West Coast from California on up through the Gulf of Alaska. And because they live so long and are slow to reproduce, we're very vulnerable to overfishing, and so have received a lot of attention for management. And that's where I got my start, was to help inform management as to what are the environmental drivers of growth, to help disentangle how the environment influences fish versus how human activities influence fish. And so I can develop these growth increment chronologies that span multiple decades. And you can imagine the amount of effort it would require to repeatedly survey an area of the ocean again and again over years and years and generations of mm-hmm. scientists. And so these ear stones in the fish where the rings form provide a shortcut to get these long histories. And so by developing these multi-decadal histories, say in California, we see that fish growth varies over time and in concert with wintertime ocean conditions. And it turns out that winter can be either boom or bust for productivity, and that fish are very sensitive to that. And we see that indices of seabird reproductive success vary also with those fish, and also indicators of plankton productivity. So all these facets of the ecosystem are co-varying together and showing us the importance of winter climate to growth and productivity in the California Current. And at the same time, we see not necessarily a long-term trend in winter climate in the mean, but in the variability, that the winter climate is becoming more and more volatile, becoming mm-hmm. more and more boom and bust, or this climate whiplash, where we also see that in precipitation on land, where mm-hmm. in recent years, California has gone through severe drought and then extreme precipitation events. The trees also record that, and they co-vary with the fish, because the same atmospheric properties that affect productivity in the ocean affect precipitation on land. And so trees give us this long record that also co-vary with the fish and the seabirds and other organisms. And the trees concur that climate is becoming more volatile over time, which is what climate models predict continuing to occur in the future. We go from drought to extreme precipitation, boom to bust, so that we see this across the marine and terrestrial environments. So it's this trend in volatility to the south. Farther north, I work with clams that live to be over 200 years old in the North Pacific. And we have divers out this week who are collecting clams off the ocean floor that will allow us to go back 1,000 years continuously for North Pacific temperature. Trees don't pick that up as well or consistently as the clams do that are growing right in the water. So over this last 1,000 years, what we're seeing now with our initial chronologies is unprecedented warming over the last 100 years, reaching a climax of extreme heat waves that you might have heard about as the colloquially referred to as the blob, these masses of warm water that have caused harmful algal blooms, closure of the salmon fishery, the Dungeness crab fishery, marine mammal strandings, seabird reproductive failures. And the clams are showing this is 5 standard deviations above the pre-industrial norm. And so provide this context that we have this warming that's really way outside of the boundaries of what's happened over the last 500 years, and hopefully we'll get that back 1,000 years. so that we can capture these various aspects of variability, of warming, using organisms that are living right in the ocean to tell us about those marine conditions.
That's really interesting. We're talking to Brian Black, Dr. Brian Black from the laboratory, the True Ring Research Laboratory at the University of Arizona. I'm interested in when you say you're studying clams or rockfish or whatever you're studying, are you heading out to the oceans and getting this, or how is your data? How are you assuming your data so that you can look at? Obviously, in the Tree Ring Lab, they bring the tree rings to the lab and they can look at them in the building. Is the same thing happening to you? Are they giving you samples that you're, or are you going out and getting those samples?
Well, I'm fortunate that most of these samples are collected for other purposes, for management of these fisheries, where, say, the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is charged with managing these fisheries, and they do surveys every year and have since the 1970s. And part of that survey is collecting the ear stone of the fish, thin sectioning it to get an age. And so they have archives of millions of otoliths from around the country that are in storage and have been used to get a base age for the fish. I can take those samples and then extract that additional level of information of how these fish have been growing and respond to climate and environment over the last several decades. And so I've worked with these fisheries labs around the country, from the Northeast, the Southeast, and the Northwest in Alaska, and globally. We, for instance, worked with a group in Norway, this Institute for Marine Research, that has cod otolith collections, the ear stones that go back to 1900, and so could be used to develop century-long histories of this very heavily exploited fish in the North Atlantic.
So this is a relatively new research that you're doing. I mean, it's kind of hasn't been done a lot in the past, so you have this vast trove of samples that you can look at. So you're at the very beginning of mapping out thousands of years worth of sea creatures and what they've recorded over that time.
That's right. I guess I'm at the point of my career where I've been doing this a good 15 years or so, but started that process of bringing the tree ring techniques to the marine systems and to the fish and clams especially. And now that is growing. And so we're developing a global network of chronologies in collaboration with other labs who are now doing this to better understand, on a global scale, just what we have, 5,000 tree ring chronologies that have been developed and are publicly available, and it would be wonderful to have that level of network for the marine system.
If anyone doubts that there's changes in our environment, to the good or to the bad, depending on how you look at it, you guys have proof that there are changes, and you have the tree rings to show it. Now you have the fish, the sea creature rings to give us that same kind of record that we can look back on and say, this is what happened 500 years ago.
That's right. The fish and the clams and corals all corroborate what we see in the terrestrial records with the trees and reinforce one another.
Very interesting research, and kudos to you for applying the tree ring research to sea creatures. And what an interesting, fascinating a way to look at the world and the history of the world. So thank you for coming in today. We really appreciate it. That's Dr. Brian Black. He's with the Tree Ring Research Lab at the University of Arizona College of Science. And very interesting topic about research in sea creatures and tree rings. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson, and we'll be back after the break, and we'll talk a little bit about another great thing going on at the University of Arizona. So, Brian, before we go, just where would they go to find out your research so that they might be able to learn a little bit more about what you're doing? Is there a website that they could go to? Or
yes, you can explore the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research website, or come do a tour. We have open tours with the whole docent group who will give you a tour of our facilities, and those can be found on the website as well. So come visit us in person.
Really fascinating experience to go down and see what's happening. And that's been going on for years. And so they have, as you said, tons of research there. And now adding to that some of this sea creature research as well. Well, thank you for coming today. This is Jump in Tucson, celebrating wonder at the University of Arizona. And we'll be back in a little bit with the second half. And thank you for coming in this morning. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. This is the Monday Wonder edition of Jump in Tucson, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. With us is an adjunct professor in the College of Social and Behavior Sciences, the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He's with the Vice President of Bose Public Affairs Group, Pete Seat. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Well, you're a 2005 graduate of the University of Arizona, and you're back teaching undergraduates yourself.
Yeah, you're dating me there, and I suppose I should get ready for our 20th reunion next year. Might have to come back out to Tucson, but yes, I have the honor and pleasure to return to campus, so to speak, as a professor, as an adjunct instructor of the American Presidency course, Political Science 205, that's taught entirely remotely online.
Well, you have an interesting trajectory. You weren't in public policy at the University of Arizona. What's your degree in from the U of A?
I got my bachelor's in theater arts.
Right.
And I will never forget then candidate for Secretary of State Jan Brewer, who of course became governor later on after I left Arizona, called me one day to ask if I would help and volunteer on her campaign. And we got to talking. She asked me that very same question. I told her I was a theater major. And she's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're so politically active in a theater major. And I said, it makes all the sense in the world, Jan. How do you think I pretend to like you?
That went over well with the governor, I'm sure, right? how did your relationship with her start? How did she know you? How did you know her?
She just met me through College Republicans. I was very involved on campus. My junior year, I was president of the campus chapter at U of A. And then my senior year, I was state chairman for the entire state federation. So I got to know a lot of the members of Congress, statewide elected officials, and others who were stomping the same grounds around that time frame.
That's interesting. So how did you come about getting back to the University of Arizona to teach a class in government policy? And how did that all transpire? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them? How did that all happen?
Like a lot of things in life, unexpected serendipity. I attended the American Enterprise Institute annual gala at the end of 2022, and I took as my plus one a fellow Wildcat, a fellow University of Arizona graduate, who herself had been at that time, I think, teaching a course remotely from DC for about 5 years. And as we were just chatting at the dinner, she asked if it was anything I would ever be interested in doing. And I had longed for an opportunity to reconnect and be connected with campus, which is difficult when you live in the state of Indiana, a different time zone, that far away from Tucson. And she said, well, if you're interested, let me make some calls, reach out to some folks. And within just a couple of weeks, we kind of had a deal and an agreement, and it took a year until I could get on the calendar because of having to develop the course and record all the lectures and, you know, line up the interviews. Just wrapped up my first semester teaching here in the spring, and we'll be back next spring in 2025.
How was that experience for you, teaching for the first time and moving into the realm of being an academic professor at a major university? What was it like to be a first-time teacher?
Exhilarating, nerve-wracking, inspiring, all those things wrapped into one. The nice thing about my background and experience is, you know, I write a lot.
Right.
I've been a published author and columnist. So I took the time to write scripts for all my lectures, which was a pretty natural process for me. And then recording the lectures felt rather natural. I actually went out to Tucson and spent 2 days in the studio there in the Harville building doing all the recordings. And so those things are the easiest parts. I learned a ton in our 7.5 weeks together with the students. And things that I will incorporate in future semesters, you know, just about assignments, how they are presented to the students, what the expectations are for them and for myself, the prevalence of ChatGPT.
Right.
Let's say that's something I learned. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was aware of it. I'd played around with it, but I don't know that I expected it would be utilized as much as it was. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it felt great. I mean, I obviously consider myself a wildcat, always will be, but to really just feel reconnected to campus, and even being on campus for those 2 days just felt really, really good to be home in a way.
Right. It gets easier as you repeat the class over and over again. It gets easier. The first one is always tough out of the box, but it's easier, and it's really an interesting process to watch students grow and learn in that. We're speaking with Pete Seed. He is with Bose Public Affairs Group out of Indianapolis, but he's an adjunct instructor at the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. So tell us a little bit about your job there as vice president of Bose and what you do in the public affairs arena as a practitioner every day.
So I am in our strategic communications practice. There are four of us. We have a government relations arm as well, and we are partnered with Bose McKinney and Evans, which is a law firm, and they occupy the three floors above me. And my colleagues here at Bose Public Affairs Group are all together on one floor in the Salesforce Tower, the tallest building in downtown Indianapolis. But I do communications consulting, media coaching at the executive level, occasionally for candidates for office. A lot of grassroots advocacy projects. So it really, really runs the spectrum and runs the gamut of what I do. Every day is different. Sometimes, you know, I'm the one that's out on the ground doing the legwork. Other times I'm, you know, behind the scenes providing the strategy and advice. And in addition to that, although it's not necessarily, you know, a defined part of my job, I also do political commentary, regularly appear on CNN and Fox and other national outlets from the comfort of my home in the Indianapolis area, and have gotten back into writing a regular column for the Indianapolis Star and USA Today.
So in your role there of being a communications expert, working in the public space and so forth, you probably have a wealth of experience. We're going to talk a little bit about how you got into the White House right after school. But we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back after the break. But on a day-to-day basis, you are then consulting multiple people at the same time. You have probably, as a law firm, you probably have many, many different clients that you guys are working with. And as you say, so you have a kind of an entrepreneurial approach to your job, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, you're always juggling a ton of balls at once, trying to keep all the clients equally happy. You know, some of the work we do does flow from the law firm. There's legal clients that right. find themselves with, you know, public relations issues that we then come in and help them manage and tackle. But occasionally, we also have work that comes our way that's completely independent of that. I'm no lawyer. I just focus on the words that people say out loud.
Right. That's fantastic. Well, we're going to talk about this class and what you've been able to concoct as a great experience for the students in the School of Government and Public Policy. And we'll talk about how you developed that. And we'll talk about some of the key people that have you've recorded some interviews with who have pretty high level people that are the students are experiencing when they take your class from you, and we'll talk a little bit about how you got started in the business at the White House as well. We're listening to Pete Seat from Bose Public Affairs Group. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, the Wonder Edition, where we talk about the wonderful and cool things that are happening at the University of Arizona. We'll be back in just a minute. Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the neat things happening at the University of Arizona and the research and experience that students get. And we're talking with Pete Seat. He is with Bose Public Affairs Group out of Indianapolis, and he's an adjunct instructor with the School of Government and Public Policy. So, Pete, you have a really interesting class that you've developed, which is where students get a glimpse inside the American presidency. And there are some White House officials who have helped you develop the curriculum and do some interviews with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of how you came up with the idea of the American presidency. And of course, that comes out of your experience of working in the White House. So tell us about your experience when you got out of school and became part of the White House staff.
Yeah, so one of the most fulfilling things I was able to do when I worked for President George W. Bush in the West Wing was give West Wing tours to friends and family. And I lost count. I kept meticulous records, but I lost count when I did my 300th tour. And, you know, these weren't tours that we had to give. These were tours that I wanted to give because it was my opportunity to showcase the White House and the most powerful room in the world, the Oval Office, to friends and family. And so that was in my mind when I pitched the idea to the folks in the School of Government and Public Policy, which was, textbooks are fine. Reading James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, that's important. But if we want to inspire true civic engagement, we have to connect students, Americans, to what is happening today, to the decisions being made today, to the people and the players who are in the room today. And so I wanted to take students into the White House, to get them as close to the White House as they could possibly get without actually being in the building. And to do that, I wanted to tap into some of my experiences being there, having worked in the building and in the West Wing, but also tap into some of the relationships that I've built and maintained over the years. And I will tell you, every single person I have asked to be a part of this class has immediately said yes. And that includes former Vice President Mike Pence, the first chief of staff in the Biden White House, Ron Klain, who happens to be from Indiana himself, the second and last chief of staff in the George W. Bush administration, who is my boss, Josh Bolton, Josh Earnest, who is the last press secretary in the Obama White House, Mike Froman, currently the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was U.S. Trade Representative in the Obama administration, Kristen Welker, currently the moderator of Meet the Press, and she moderated the second and final presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in 2020, and Shayla Craighead, who was a White House photographer when I was in the Bush White House and then became the chief official White House photographer in the Trump administration, and brought them all in for anywhere between 30 and 45 minute conversations, exclusive conversations just for this class, really diving into, you know, the process of the White House, what their day-to-day lives were like, you know, some of the challenges they faced. One of the questions I asked Mike Pence was, you know, how do you wrap your mind around being next in line? How do you wrap your mind around the fact that anytime that phone rings, it could be someone telling you, hey, you're now president? There's only one person at any given time in this country who knows what that feels like. And, you know, had the opportunity to ask him that question and for students to hear his response.
That's amazing. And to have those high-level officials from the White House be able to share their perspective is just invaluable for the students in the class. And this is an undergraduate-level class for, I would imagine, juniors and seniors in the college. Is that what I assume?
Yes, it is. And hopefully I'm not getting ahead of any official or formal announcement, but I believe it will be offered as part of Gen Ed, the general education curriculum, perhaps as early as next year. So the doors will be open to more and more students to have this opportunity to hear from these folks. And I do want to highlight, as I went through that list, what was very important to me also from the beginning was not just getting, you know, students that front row seat, but also ensuring that it was a bipartisan collection of individuals so they could see the interaction. I mean, I made a joke with Josh Earnest at the beginning. He, of course, is a Democrat. I'm a Republican. And I said, you know, you and I, Josh, are proving that Republicans and Democrats can actually still talk to each other and not want to punch each other in the face. And, you know, that's part of it. And I hope that gets across to the students that we can have these conversations about the presidency. You know, it's not about Donald Trump's presidency or about Biden's presidency in our class. It's about the American presidency. And that's what each of these conversations revolves around.
You have some pretty unique assignments for them. They have to write a letter to the editor to try and put their position forward for in support of a candidate, which is always a unique thing to do. I'm sure that you got some varied responses there as to who they wanted to endorse or fall on the sword for. That was an interesting assignment, I assume.
Yeah, you even though it's remote and online and you're never face-to-face with any of the students, you certainly get to learn a lot about them and their personalities and where they are on, you know, on the issues. But yeah, the letter to the editor assignment was something I wanted the students to do so they had that experience and could hopefully at some point down the road do it in real life if they had an issue that they're incredibly passionate about, or write an op-ed, or you know, go testify at a hearing in their local city council or perhaps the state legislature. Also ask them to put together their dream cabinet. You know, we talked about the selection of personnel and cabinet right. members in a White House and how presidents approach that. So I said, put together your cabinet, real people, and give me the real reason why. Why do you think these people would be good for that job? I also had them do a couple of video assignments where, you know, they had to brief me pretending I was the president. They were playing the press secretary and they had to brief me on, you know, how we would roll out several different announcements, where it should take place, who should be there, what the tone of the event should be, to kind of think through all the different mechanics that are involved in communicating a message from the White House.
A very interesting a topic and a great set of assignments for students to get some real-world learning, some applied learning for something. I know that Dr. Mark Stegeman and others who are working on the civics component of general ed and trying to create a couple of classes, and yours might be one of them, where they are trying to give a little bit more civic education to the undergraduates at the University of Arizona. And I think this is part of that initiative where it's to try and engage the current undergraduates in their own government and their own, whether it be in their municipality or whether it be on the national level, to get engaged and to be engaged and be informed and to know what they're doing, how they can engage in the process. So this is a great class for that.
I absolutely agree. I guess I pat myself on the back when it comes to that. But, you yeah. know, I just hope that students, when they read the news, they watch the news, they have a better appreciation for the difficulty of making decisions at the presidential level. And it's very easy when we wear our partisan jerseys to see everything as easy, good, bad, you know, evil, not evil. And sometimes the best decision is to do nothing. Right. Sometimes the best decision is right in the middle of everything. And that will anger folks on both sides. But, you know, we talked to, especially with the former chiefs of staff, about that process and just, you know, how presidents grapple with the decision making there. So I hope they have a better appreciation for the process and just how important their voices are in our representative democracy.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Pete, and thank you for the good work you're doing at the University of Arizona in this unique class about the American presidency. And we appreciate your perspective and bringing all those top-level executives to the students for them to learn a little bit about what it's like to be the President of the United States. Thanks for joining us. This is Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Monday with another in the Wonder series about the University of Arizona.